From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! The big squeeze, tough times for the American worker. Today, New York Times labor reporter Stephen Greenhouse examines how the majority of the American workforce is working more but earning less. First, a look at the state of the newspaper industry. In recent months, more than 6,000 print journalists have lost their jobs. Newspaper circulation is down, and so is advertising revenue, page counts, and stock prices. We'll host a roundtable discussion. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. In Iraq, more than 60 people were killed and another 250 wounded Monday in suicide bombings in Baghdad and Kirkuk. Four women carried out the attacks, three of them strapping themselves with the bombs. It was one of the deadliest attacks on Iraqi civilians in months. In Pakistan, at least six people have been killed in a U.S. missile strike on a northwestern village. The attack reportedly killed Abu Kabab al-Masri, a top operative for al-Qaeda. The bombing came as Pakistan's new prime minister, Yousaf Raza Gilani, was in Washington for meetings at the White House. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is claiming Iran is making progress in international talks over its nuclear program. In an interview with NBC News, Ahmadinejad said Iran could find common ground with the U.S. and five other nations.
We are not working to manufacture a bomb. We don't believe in a nuclear bomb. Nuclear bombs belong to the 20th century. We are living in the new century. Nuclear energy must not be equal to a nuclear bomb.
Iran has until Saturday to reply to an international offer to halt U.N. sanctions in return for a nuclear freeze. In Israel and the occupied territories, the Israeli government has announced it will refuse to negotiate the long-term status of Jerusalem as part of ongoing peace talks with Palestinian leaders. On Monday, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said a deal could be reached on other issues, but that Jerusalem won't even be discussed until at least next year. Palestinians have long called for East Jerusalem as the capital of any future state. In Gaza, Hamas leader Mahmoud al-Zahar criticized the Israeli move.
No peace process will be achieved either in this year or in the expected years. Israel, and backed by America, is not intended to give the Palestinian people the basic demand by establishment of an independent state. And for this reason, we resorted to the military activities in order to push the occupation and to make an end by an alternative method.
Israel's decision coincided with another demolition of a Palestinian residential building in East Jerusalem. Israeli officials say the owner hadn't obtained the proper permits. Israel has demolished hundreds of Palestinian homes over the last decade. Meanwhile, the Israeli government has instructed several top officials not to visit Spain after a Spanish judge approved an international arrest warrant against them for allegedly committing war crimes. A Spanish human rights group filed a case over an Israeli airstrike in 2002. 16 Palestinian civilians were killed when Israel bombed a crowded area in the heart of central Gaza. Israel says it was targeting a senior Hamas leader who was killed in the attack. Here in the United States, the Bush administration has admitted it will leave behind a record budget deficit of around $490 billion. The figure is more than $80 billion over President Bush's forecast earlier this year. The projection is likely too small because the White House hasn't requested war funding for the entire year. An internal probe has found top Justice Department officials practice routine political discrimination in hiring for top positions. Applicants were disqualified for everything from links to Democratic Party politics and rumors of a homosexual lifestyle. Less experienced Republicans were given priority, including one lawyer who drew raves for his position on, quote, God, guns, and gays. The report focuses on the conduct of senior aides to former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, including former top advisor Monica Goodling and former Chief of Staff Kyle Sampson. The officials relied on a White House internet search technique to vet the political views of potential employees. The aides searched for the applicants' names, along with such keywords as abortion, homosexual, Florida recount, and guns. The Environmental Protection Agency's Enforcement Office has told employees to direct any outside inquiries to a small group of officials rather than answer the questions themselves. According to the Washington Post, an EPA memo cites any contact from reporters, congressional investigators, and the EPA's inspector general. The memo says, quote, please do not respond to questions or make any statements. Critics say the move will further endanger employees who speak out against political interference with their work. A recent survey found more than half of EPA officials have encountered political interference in the past 5 years. In Tennessee, the assailant in Sunday's deadly church shooting in Knoxville has told police he targeted the congregation because it was known for socially liberal and gay-friendly views. Two people were killed and eight others were wounded when Jim Atkinson walked into the church and opened fire with a shotgun. Knoxville Police Chief Sterling Owen said the attack is being treated as a hate crime.
It appears that what brought him to this horrible event was his lack of being able to obtain a job, his frustration over that, and his stated hatred for the liberal movement. We have recovered a four-page letter in which he describes his feelings and his the reason that he claims that he committed these offenses.
A government audit has found the private military company Blackwater has obtained dozens of contracts meant for small businesses. The Inspector General of the Small Business Administration says Blackwater was awarded $110 million in small business contracts, despite uncertainty over whether it qualifies as a small business. From 2005 to 2007, Blackwater was awarded 30 contracts intended for companies with revenues under $6.5 million. Blackwater's revenues exceeded $200 million for each of those years. Meanwhile, another government audit has found tens of millions of dollars have been wasted on a Pentagon contract to build security facilities in Iraq. Stuart Bowen, the Special Inspector General for Iraq, says contractor Parsons Delaware completed just one-third of a $900 million project. In banking news, federal regulators have shut down two banks in California and Nevada. First National Bank of Nevada and the Californian First Heritage Bank were both folded for lacking sufficient capital. The closures come 2 weeks after the collapse of the California bank IndyMac. And in Louisiana, prosecutors have announced a plan to seek the indictment of a white officer in the tasing death of a young African-American man in the town of Winfield. Baron Pikes died on January 17th from electrocution after the police officer shot him 9 times with a taser. Pikes was already in handcuffs at the time. Last month, his death was ruled a homicide. Pikes was the first cousin of Michael Bell, the lead defendant in the Jenna 6 case. Prosecutors say they'll convene a grand jury next month. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. We begin today by examining the state of newspapers in this country. Newspapers have been one of the primary sources of news the world over for more than 300 years. They have endured despite onslaughts from radio, television, and most recently, the internet. But newspapers in the United States, are they now on their final leg? Nearly 6,000 newspaper journalists across the country have lost their jobs in recent months. The same period has witnessed a sharp decline in newspaper stocks, advertising revenues, page counts, and circulation. On Monday, shares in A.H. Below Corporation plunged, and the owner of the Dallas Morning News said it would cut 500 jobs. Job cuts have also been drastic at Tribune-owned newspapers, including the Chicago Tribune, the Los Angeles Times, the Orlando Sun-Sentinel, Newsday, and the Baltimore Sun. Real estate mogul Sam Zell took over the Tribune company 6 months ago. A recent study by the Pew Research Center shows that the coverage of international as well as national news has suffered as a result of the cutbacks. Nearly two-thirds of American newspapers cover less foreign and national news now than they did 3 years ago. Only four American newspapers even have foreign desks. Today, a discussion on the state of the newspaper industry. We're joined by three guests. Bernard Lunzer is president of the Newspaper Guild and vice president of the Communication Workers of America. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Chris Hedges is a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. He spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times and is co-author of the new book, Collateral Damage. His latest article for Truthdig is called Bad Days for Newsrooms and Democracy. He joins us here in the Firehouse studio. And we're also joined on the telephone from San Francisco by Linda Jew. She is the director of New Voices in Independent Journalism and the past president of the Society of Professional Journalists Northern California chapter. I want to welcome all of you to Democracy Now! And I'd like to begin with Bernard Lunzer. Could you give us a sense from your perspective as the leader of the major union for newspaper workers in the country, what is happening in the newsrooms right now?
Well, there's just a lot of fear, almost a sense of panic in many places. You know, in 2 months alone, there'll be additional 2,000 cuts with Below's announced cuts yesterday. And so there's just a lot of fear and uncertainty. People don't know. Those that can are looking for other jobs. Those that can't are concerned about the workload that's left behind and what kind of product is going to actually be produced. So it's a very scary time. And as the stocks continue to plunge, you know, there's more fear that you go through one round of buyouts and then you end up with layoffs and then you wait for the next round. So that's sort of what's happening right now on the ground.
Well, Bernie, I'd like to get this clear. Most of these newspapers are not actually losing money, right? And, when the Knight Ridder disappeared and was bought up by the McClatchy Company, it was still getting about a 15% return on sales every year. So why are they going through this enormous, basically, collapse of the industry?
Well, the market has put considerable pressure on them, for sure, and it's a problem. I mean, there's real concern that the current ownership model is not going to survive and that new forms of publications and new ownership models are going to have to take over. So clearly, Wall Street is a big part of the problem as the stocks decline. The profitability is still probably fairly healthy in some cases, but you have to remember newspapers were used to getting 20, even 30% profit margins during the heyday. And they were addicted to those profit margins. You know, it was C. Peter McClatchy, who was in the McClatchy chain, who said, you know, the problem with newspapers is that they were too profitable. And that continues to be a problem. There's a legitimate revenue problem. Clearly, in the case of Sam Zell and some of these others, Avista Capital in Minneapolis, they paid too much. They're over-leveraged. There's too much debt. But part of it is just the problem with too much belief that they have to get profits that are not there.
Linda Ju, I was with you this past weekend at the Unity Journalists of Color convention in Chicago, and you mentioned especially the impact on the Bay Area in one of your presentations in one of the workshops, the impact on the Bay Area of journalists.
Yeah. Media News owns 29 newspapers in Northern California, and they've just gone through their fourth layoff in a year. And the estimates are probably over 1,000 employees, and we're expecting more to be laid off. So, and I think, you know, more than just the employment issue, the coverage of those communities that where the media newspapers are located have been severely affected. But what they are telling the employees that are remaining is that, you know, the coverage is going to stay the same. Even if and maybe even get better, but they'll just find different ways to do it. And you know, what's surprising to me is that many of the employees actually believe this, or they want to believe this. So, and the impact is it's pretty bad. It's pretty bad, and I think there's a kind of a post-traumatic shock syndrome going on now with the employees that have been laid off.
Chris Hedges, what about that? That the coverage is going to get better with all of this, all of these reductions in staff, and especially the foreign coverage. You were a foreign correspondent for many years at the New York Times, and the fact that so many of these operations now, even newspaper operations, have shut down their foreign bureaus. And what's the impact, especially in an increasingly globalized economy like we live in now?
First of all, we've already seen a deterioration in the coverage, so the notion that it's going to get better, I think, is just not borne out. You know, increasingly newspapers in print form are replicating, trying to replicate the web, and to a certain extent trying to replicate what we see on television, which has been a complete disintegration of serious news gathering. But I think the important issue here concerns the internet. There has been an assumption, which I think is false, that newspapers will make the transition to the internet, that the internet is just another delivery system. And it's not. As Marshall McLuhan understood, every new technology creates its new reality, often an invisible reality. And newspapers, big and small, have long had websites now, but they have not made that transition. Only 10% of ad revenue goes to the internet. In terms of national figures, it's about $21 billion a year, which is a very small percentage of revenues. And I think that the crisis that is hitting newspapers across the country, which we've just detailed, is at its core because it is a kind of realization and is a kind of panic that newsprint is dying, at least the large, big dailies. We'll still get those sort of free dailies they hand out on the Metro designed to be read in 20 minutes, which are essentially advertising rags with virtually no reporting. But the large newspapers are dying, and the internet is not going to replace them. They are not going to make that transfer from newsprint to the internet, and that is what is the crisis. And I think that the crisis is one that is severe not only for the news gathering industry, but for our democracy as a whole. There's been a terrible corruption, of course, of the news gathering industry, in large part because, courtesy, thanks to the Clinton administration, we now have five corporations essentially controlling everything that we read, see, hear, and ultimately think. And of course, that fusion of entertainment and news is one that has been completely has been devastating to those of us who care about impartial and honest news gathering. So what we're seeing is people retreating into sort of these intellectual ghettos in the internet, where people were very little reporting is done. I mean, I think if you look at the blogosphere, it's very clear that there's a parasitic quality. They feed off of the wire services and the newspapers, which probably account for about 80% of all news gathering. When that's gone, we are just going to descend into kind of packaging and partisanship and propaganda. And what my deepest fear is that the future of news will end up looking like the Drudge Report.
I'm sure there'd be lots of people who conduct blogs who would question your use of the word of them as parasites. Some people advocate that actually this is the beginning of a new era, very much how, like the early newspapers in the early 1800s, where you're basically getting a whole new medium, opening up the opportunity for more citizen journalism, and eventually this will filter itself out into new developed media companies. What's your sense of that?
I believe that if there was reporting on the internet. Most of the bloggers don't even pick up a phone, much less go out and report a story. Reporting a story, especially doing an investigative piece, is laborious, expensive, time-consuming, and, you know, I don't want to elevate journalism beyond what it is. It's a trade, like being a carpenter or anything else, but it does take a certain amount of skill and a certain amount of knowledge, and there are a few sites, ProPublica, Slate, Truthdig, which I write for, do this, but of course, they're very, very small operations when compared with a city newsroom. Newspapers, at their best, and there has been a steady decline in their quality over the last couple decades, but at their best, they send people out to cover City Hall, local politics, arts, theater, sports. I don't see that that's going to be replicated on the internet, and that really frightens me.
You know, let me jump in
Linda,
for a second, if
yes.
I may. I'm not sure that I agree entirely with what you're saying, Chris, because I am witnessing, actually, in the Bay Area, numerous new enterprises starting to come up, being formed actually by journalists to find new business models that would be sustain very good journalism and ethical reporting. And so right now, I think maybe, you know, I would say that things are up in the air, and yes, the newspaper model is disintegrating. I agree. I think print seems to be on its way out. I wouldn't exactly, you know, I'm not yet ready to call the last rights on it, but I do think that there are some viable models out there that are coming out that we haven't heard about. And I would say that, you know, there are actually new services that have been out there for even maybe close to 5 or 6 years now that are trying to make up for the loss of reporting and quality coverage that we've been seeing decline over the last year. So I wouldn't totally rule out that the internet can't fill in that vacuum. We had the Society of Professional Journalists Northern California held an expo, a journalism expo in Silicon Valley that was co-hosted by Yahoo, and brought together a couple of hundred journalists to actually look at that question. And it was quite surprising to see the number of enterprises and the new models of collaboration and new revenue models that they're cooking up that would not be solely advertising-based. And so I'm a lot less pessimistic than you are about what's going on.
Well, revenue is the key. Mm-hmm. ProPublica receives essentially outside donations, funding, the same with Truthdig. You know, and if you can't, I mean, reporting, especially if you do foreign reporting. I mean, the first year I was the Balkan bureau chief during the war in Yugoslavia. My first year budget for the New York Times was $600,000, and that didn't include salary. It's, you know, to do investigative reporting is, I just don't see where the money's going to come from to support it.
Yeah, well, actually, foundations are actually beginning to look at that more. And there are new cooperative models that are being proposed right now, business proposals that are being proposed right now that I know of, to deal with the issue of foreign reporting and also to deal with the problems of in-depth investigative reporting. In fact, my program is one of them. My program is actually aimed at developing more investigative reporters of color to pursue public interest journalism. And there are other programs like that that are just, you know, beginning to pop up all over the place. Now, granted, they're not going to have the kind of scale yet that, you know, larger news organizations have and are used to. But I think the actual the new theme here in terms of, you know, these new enterprises is actually smaller, faster, and cheaper, sort of like NASA. And I think that's the way we have to go.
Well, Linda, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue this discussion. We're talking with Linda Ju, former head of the Society of Professional Journalists Northern California chapter, Chris Hedges, a former reporter for The New York Times, and now with the Nation Institute, and Bernie Lunzer, the new president of the Newspaper Guild. We'll be back in a moment. Was greeted by the Brentford All-Stars here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. We're talking about the state of the newspaper industry. Our guests are Bernard Lunzer, the president of the Newspaper Guild and the vice president of the Communication Workers of America. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Chris Hedges is a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. He spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent for The New York Times and is co-author of the new book, Collateral Damage. His latest article for Truth Dig is called Bad Days for Newsrooms and Democracy. He joins me here in the Firehouse studio. And joining us on the telephone from San Francisco is Linda Ju. She is the director of New Voices in Independent Journalism and the past president of the Society of Professional Journalists Northern California chapter. I'd like to get back to Bernie Lunzer. We contacted the Tribune Company to invite them on the program. They declined, but they did send us a statement. Gary Whiteman, the senior vice president of corporate relations, writes, quote, "We have gotten a great deal of attention for the actions we're taking at our newspapers to address the issues we and our peers face. Declining revenue, secular difficulties facing our major advertising groups, and the expansion of media choices available to consumers. Clearly, as you recognize, we're not alone. I would point out, however, that at the end of the day, we had the largest news gathering staffs in our markets and the second and third largest in the country in Chicago and Los Angeles. That is true even after implementing the staff reductions to which you refer." Bernie, your response, you know that Tribune has been at the center, at least in this latest wave of the various layoffs and buyout programs at the various newspapers.
Right. We're very concerned. And, of course, I've watched very closely what's happened at the Baltimore Sun, the loss of all the international bureaus and that kind of coverage. But it's important to note that what they're doing is having a great effect on local coverage as well. Great losses there. We think in many cases, the other day, Sam Zell made the statement that he's not going to sell any more newspapers in 2008. But we think in some cases that it might be better if Zell were to consider selling more of the empire and breaking it off. We hope that local ownership would actually create more responsibility and more response back to the local market and to local communities that really are going to be the ones that are the biggest losers in this. We see, less is less, and we need to say that out loud. The subscribers are not fools. They can see that these products have been diminished. So you have this danger of getting into this cycle. We're hearing that Tribune Company is going to save journalism through all these cuts. That's not what we're seeing. That's not what we're feeling. We're feeling that basically it's just a self-fulfilling cycle of a downward spiral.
What about the old model was that these chains began to grow, Gannett, Knight Ritter, obviously the Hearst and Pulitzer chains earlier on in the century, but then you had these major media conglomerates across platforms. But now, apparently, many of these companies now are in trouble because they took on too much debt or because their shareholders are demanding a maximum return. What about the, right. But you're saying that the return to local, more locally owned companies would solve the problem. What if those are just private venture capitalists, as they are in many of the instances now, private equity groups that are taking over these local publications?
Well, we can see that's not a great solution. Minneapolis is an example of that. Avista is a private equity firm that bought the Star Tribune, and that has not worked out well, and they're trying to, manage their debt right now. They've missed some payments. So there is a problem with the market, and we talked about alternative publications, but there is a, real question of as to whether or not we can build employee stock-owned papers, whether we can build co-op models. There are different models, and some of us are starting to believe that we may have to rescue newspapers from the market itself for these things to survive, for any quality journalism to survive.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's absolutely right. The ownership model is what the problem is. One of the things that I want to bring out is that the Northern California chapter of SBJ is beginning to conduct a study on the impact of coverage on the communities as a result of these layoffs from Media News, beginning with Media News, since that seems to be the most recent and most public layoffs, and we will be looking at other newspapers. But we are looking at the effects on the 29 communities because there really hasn't been any documented data on the reduction of quality of coverage. And one of the questions that we're also looking at is whether or not journalists are willing to actually become owners of some of these newspapers themselves. So, I think the ownership question really needs to be addressed. And one of the biggest areas of coverage that is missing is the coverage of the newspaper buyouts and layoffs as a really good, aggressive business story. I think if we had much better coverage on what's going on with the business by the journalists themselves, we'd have a much more informed public about the actual consequences.
I'd like to ask Chris Hedges on this ownership issue. Frank Blethyn, who's been one of the maverick publishers of the Seattle Times, he's always been opposed to media concentration, has been recently putting forth the idea that maybe the government should get involved through tax policies in helping to foster the continuation of local newspapers, just as it does in other areas of the economy, not necessarily get involved in the content, but just to preserve local newspapers and their ability to function. What's your sense about the ownership issue?
BBC model, where you impose a sort of small tax on everybody to sustain a serious news gathering as part of a functioning democracy. That's not a bad model. I think if you look at the family-owned newspapers, the Washington Post and the New York Times, I guess the last two big family-owned papers, you just saw an attempt to essentially a hostile takeover by hedge fund managers. They did get two seats on the board.
With the
New York Times. And the Sulzbergers do have a sense that, this is a business, but it's also a public trust. Whether that model can be sustained, the New York Times itself is going through difficult times. I mean, stock is down to about $12. It has gone through layoffs and buyouts as well. I mean, part of it is ownership. Part of it is just the antiquated nature of newsprint as a conveyor of information. And I think that just as we saw with the rise of television, had an impact on newspapers. Now we're seeing the internet. I want to go back just to the internet quickly, because it's not totally about ownership. It is about the medium itself. The average reader of the paper copy of the New York Times spends 45 minutes reading the paper. The average viewer of the New York Times website spends about 7 minutes. The internet is not designed for a literate society. We are moving into a post-literate society, a society where information, and of course a very limited quality, is portrayed primarily through images. The internet can make that fusion between print and images, but the medium itself will determine the content. To somehow look at the internet as simply another delivery system is a mistake. So there are many factors that go in here. Ownership model, I think that we have to face the fact that news and papers are no longer efficient in terms of economic terms and in terms of speed. I mean, you see that soul searching that was done when I was at the paper. Well, everybody already knows what the news story is, so we have to focus on news analysis. We have to focus on investigative pieces because people no longer get their news, the news event from the newspaper itself.
Linda, what about this issue that the medium is a message, that the internet itself defines a new way and not necessarily a more complete or comprehensive way for people to get their information?
Yeah, I have to say that for the longest time, I actually, follow the same line of thinking as Chris. And what I'm slowly coming around to is understanding that, yes, the internet is not a good medium for delivering long-form, in-depth reporting. And I don't think that we should try to, plug a square peg into a round hole that way. But I think that, realistically, we have to look at ways to generate attention, to use the internet to drive attention to longer-form reporting that can be found elsewhere, including print. And, I think that one of the biggest mistakes being made right now is the rush to try to grab the attention of young people by developing news in short bites so that they can be transmitted over the cell phone. There's just no way that you can do that and really do justice to the news. So I agree. I think there are issues around that, but I think we have to come to terms with the fact that the new media exists, and we have to figure out ways to drive people's attention, capture their attention first using the new media, and then driving them back to possibly print or even back to broadcast or other media.
And Bernie Lunzer of the Newspaper Guild, what strategies is your union, or the Communication Workers of America, developing to try to confront this new reality that you're facing for your members?
Well, a couple of things. One, we have been pursuing for some time employee stock ownership strategies, and we're hoping to actually have an announcement very soon where we might have finally been able to bring one of these to fruition. Can't comment on it right now, but we believe there is going to be a future for print, but we're not naive. We also understand that there has to be innovation. We've been willing to bargain concessions where necessary, but we think the biggest mistake is that the owners and the publishers have not been talking to the frontline workers about that kind of innovation. So what we're trying to do, where we have to do concessions, we want to trade that for real involvement, real committees that are able to work on a better business model, on the future of the product. We still believe that there's a place for quality journalism, that people will want it. I don't mean to plug a product, but the Times Reader, which is a software that allows you to view the New York Times online in a whole different way, is an example of just sort of one transition of how longer stories can be read on the internet. There's a lot of room for innovation, not just in news, but also in advertising. And we think that they have squandered a lot of time. One plug I want to put in, Juan, is that we also need to fight the push to more consolidation. The FCC changed the rules in December that would allow for more cross-ownership. We're pushing very hard. There's a bill in the House right now we're trying to get pushed through that would reverse those rules. We think if there's more consolidation, more cross-ownership between broadcast and print, there will be less innovation. And I would tell you that most of the people you talk to in broadcast understand that broadcast is only 5 or 6 years behind print in terms of the effect that the internet is having on the traditional delivery systems.
All right, well, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Well, this is an issue that we'll continue to cover. I'd like to thank our guests, Bernie Lunzer, the president of the Newspaper Guild and vice president of the Communication Workers of America, Chris Hedges, senior fellow at the Nation Institute, former correspondent for the New York Times, and Linda Jew is the director of New Voices in Independent Journalism. Thanks to all of you. When we come back, New York Times labor reporter Steve Greenhouse joins us to talk about his new book, The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. Stay with us. We young people can make it work. Come together and make it work. Yeah. We can make it work. We can make it work. Marley here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. The federal minimum wage increased last week from $5.85 to $6.55. The increase gave nearly 2 million American workers a raise. The 70-cent increase is the second of three enacted under a 2007 law that saw the first minimum wage hike in more than a decade. But adjusted for inflation, the minimum wage remains lower in real terms than it was 40 years ago, despite record corporate profits. A new book by the New York Times labor reporter Stephen Greenhouse examines how much of the American workforce is working more but earning less. Wages have stagnated, health and pension benefits have grown stingier, and job security has shriveled. The book is titled The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. Stephen Greenhouse joins us here in the Firehouse studio. Welcome.
Nice to be here, Juan.
Amazing book, Steve. You've traveled all around America, obviously, as a labor reporter for the New York Times, and you take us into all kinds, not just the factories, but the Silicon Valley jobs, the service jobs, to give us a sense of what is happening to the everyday worker.
We all love Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Nickel and Dimed, and I felt I'm going to try building on that, and I really try looking across the board what's happening to the nation's workers. I look at, you know, farm workers, I look at Microsoft workers, I look at, you know, factory workers whose jobs are disappearing to Mexico, and I look at, you know, software engineers at Hewlett Packard, at some other places, you know, that have lost their jobs to India. I look at, you know, janitors in Houston who, I focus on one janitor in Houston who after 10 years was making just $5.25 an hour. I write about a Dominican worker in Brooklyn who works 11 hours a day for just $35 a day. The whole panoply of what's happening to show that there's this big squeeze on the nation's workers where, as you were just saying, wages have been flat, health and pension benefits are getting worse. At the same time, corporate profits have, you know, gone up very, very nicely. Employee productivity has gone up 15-20%, yet wages have been flat. Plus, companies are pressuring workers, you know, to work harder and harder.
The health insurance situation. I think you had a starting story about one worker, a security guard, who had caught many shoplifters at his store. He's hurts himself in the process of capturing one of them or arresting one of them, and then ends up being fired because now he requires medical treatment that his employer doesn't want to give him. The impact of the health insurance crisis on America's workers.
I read about this worker, Mike Michelle, who works as a security guard for a Walmart in Texas, and he was a great security guard. He caught 180 shoplifters over a two-year period. One day, he runs out into the parking lot to chase after someone who's using stolen checks. The woman's accomplice floors the accelerator, hits Mike, you know, messes up his back, breaks his kneecap. You know, Mike asks for a few weeks off because he needs surgery on his knee. He applies to workers' comp, and boom, he's fired. And this shows how companies sometimes retaliate against people who file for workers' comp, and that's part of a broader health crisis in the nation where, since the year 2000, even though we've had pretty good economic times until the last few months, 9 million more Americans are out of work than was the case in 2000. So now almost 50 million Americans, nearly one-sixth of the workforce, is uninsured. And you think how crazy that is in ways. You know, we're the world's wealthiest nation, yet one in six workers are out of work. And another, you know, health statistic that surprised me when I was researching the book was the United States spends about $6,500 per person for health coverage, which is more than twice what France and Germany spend, about two and a half times what Japan spend. Yet, you know, they have universal health coverage. They have longer lifespans than Americans. Yet, you know, we spend twice as much, and one in six people are uninsured. So something is badly broken in the health system.
Now, given the record corporate profits that we've seen and the relative prosperity of so many American companies over recent decades, why is it, or do we have this continuing spiral downward in terms of the living standard of the average worker?
If there's any one theme in my book, Juan, it's that, you know, things are out of whack, out of balance in the workplace, that, you know, corporate profits have hit record levels. Employee productivity has really zoomed upward 15-20% over the past 6-7 years. Yet, you know, wages have gone nowhere. You know, corporate profits as a percentage of overall national income have hit record levels, and wages as a percentage of income, national income, have, you know, fallen to the lowest level since basically the Depression. So what's wrong here? That's a good question. I think part of it is that, you know, employees, unions have much less bargaining power, much less power vis-a-vis corporations than was the case 30, 40, 50 years ago. Part of that's weaker unions. Part of that is globalization has really increased corporate power over workers because corporations can tell employees, look, if you don't accept the wage freeze, we'll just move your job to China or India. If you're too vocal in demanding, wage increases, raises, well, maybe you'll be caught up in the next round of downsizing. So I think globalization has really enabled corporations to increase pressure. And another thing, Juan, is, you know, Wall Street. I think Wall Street, since the 1980s and the rise of the institutional investor, the rise of mutual funds, hedge funds, pension funds, Wall Street is exerting much more pressure on corporations to maximize their share prices, as you know, which means maximize profits, which often translates into lowering costs and especially lowering payroll costs. A lot of managers will say, you know, the area where they have most flexibility to reduce costs and increase profits is on payroll. So that's why we've seen all these waves of downsizing.
You know, one of the things that I've often wondered about, especially over the last 20 years, is as we've both covered the labor movement for many years, and is that the impact of the lack of alternatives on the world scale, that it seems that during the period when there were a considerable number of socialist countries in the world, for all their problems that these countries had, they at least provided an alternative vision of the kinds of societies, how workers would be treated. And as a result, the capitalist countries almost had to provide more benefits to their workers to prevent them from trying to institute a socialist society. So that, in essence, once the socialist camp collapsed, They're really the Western capitalists felt that pretty much, hey, we don't have to worry about our workers taking any other role, so we can do whatever we want with them. It seems to me that in some degree, one benefit to us in the United States and Europe by the existence of the Soviet Union and China, all these others, was that the governments had to be more careful about how they treated their workers. Any thoughts on that?
I kind of saw that there are three camps. There's like the American, you know, almost extreme free market model. There was the Western European kind of social democracy model. And then there was the socialist communist model of China, Russia. So that model has kind of fallen, the lesson has kind of fallen by the wayside, but I still think, you know, there's a very strong Western European model, which still remains quite different from the American model. And you speak to a lot of, you know, union people here, liberals here, progressives here, they say, well, we should have a lot more of what Western Europe has. You know, in researching the book, I was kind of surprised, even shocked, that the United States is the only industrial nation without universal health coverage. We're the only industrial nation without, actually one of the very few nations in the world, one of four nations in the world without paid maternity leave. We're the only industrialized nation without a law saying everyone gets X number of vacation days. In the European Union, the 27 nations, every worker is guaranteed 4 weeks vacation. And also, we're the only industrialized nation where workers are not by law guaranteed a set number of paid sick days. So, you know, I think we still have a lot to learn from the so-called social democracies of Europe in terms of, you know, their model versus our model.
And hopefully they will last long enough for us to learn from them. let me ask you about our labor movement. Obviously, a few years back, there was a big battle and division within the American labor movement between the AFL-CIO and the establishment of a new Change to Win coalition led by the SEIU and others. But that coalition really hasn't appeared to have had much of an impact on the overall direction that the labor movement is going in. What's your sense of how this is shaking out, this split in the American and organized labor?
The unions that quit the AFL-CIO, the service employees, the Unite Here apparel hotel workers, the Teamsters, the United Food and Commercial Workers, they say they wanted to leave the AFL-CIO to give them an opportunity to grow faster and mobilize more. I think you're right, Juan. We haven't yet seen real big changes in how much these unions have been organizing. The service employees were organizing, you know, more workers than any other union. Before the split, they continue to organize more than any other union. Unite Here was doing a lot of organizing before the split. It still is. But, you know, some of the unions in Change to Win that weren't doing much organizing before, like the Teamsters, like the United Food and Commercial Workers, unfortunately, they're still not doing much organizing. We keep hearing that the Change to Win is working very hard with these unions to turn things around. You know, in the book, I write about one kind of Change to Win or service employees organizing drive that does hold out a lot of hope for the labor movement. I write about the service employees' effort to unionize 5,300 janitors in Houston. And the workers there really had it bad. I mentioned, you know, this worker who worked 10 years as a janitor at a luxury office building where after 10 years she was still making $5.25 an hour. And she was an immigrant from El Salvador, refugee from El Salvador. And so she got involved in this unionization drive. And, you know, the workers, these 5,300 janitors, virtually all of them were immigrants. Virtually none of them spoke English. Many of them were undocumented. They were all part-time. They were all subcontracted. I mean, a very, very, very hard population to organize. And to boot, in a state that's one of the most, Texas, one of the most anti-union in the nation, and the service employees, you know, we're able to unionize them using some very smart tactics that I describe in detail. And as a result of the contract, the workers' wages rise, you know, 60% over 3 years. They go from 20 hours a week to 30 hours a week. So in effect, their wages double in 3 years. Plus, they get health insurance. And I think that's a wonderful model of how unions can still do important work in helping low-wage workers. You know, could they have done that before the split? Yes. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the split really was needed to do that.
We're talking with Steve Greenhouse, the labor reporter for the New York Times, and he's written a new book, The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. In talking about the SEIU, which is obviously the, I guess, the preeminent union right now in the United States, certainly the fastest growing and most politically influential, they've had their troubles too in recent years, because as they've grown, there's also been criticism that they've become increasingly sort of making arrangements or deals with companies or with political leaderships in order to get what they call a card check or neutrality agreements to bring in thousands and thousands of workers at one time, but that some are criticizing them for being too much of a top-down organization rather than practicing the sort of the rank-and-file democracy that unions have long espoused, at least in theory. Your sense of how these internal conflicts among the reformers in the labor movement are shaking out now?
There are the service employees, I agree, are the fastest growing union in the nation. I often think of the phrase about Reggie Jackson and the Yankees. They're the rod that stirs the drink in the labor movement. They're really, kicking ass in many ways. They're doing a lot. But there's a big debate within the union that, Andy Stern, the leader who is in many ways the most visionary leader in the labor movement, people say, oh, he's too top down. He doesn't listen enough to what's happening at the grassroots. And Stern, and he's having a big fight with the head of the union's biggest healthcare union in California, headed by Sal Roselli. But Stern says, I'm pushing ahead. We're doing what's needed to grow, and we have a good vision, and come along with us. As in any big institution, there are frictions, as you say, Juan, they have made some pragmatic choices that they'll give perhaps some concessions on wages with a company to persuade that company to make it easier to allow card check when SEIU is trying to organize some of their non-union operations in other states. So there's a big debate about how many concessions should one make in order to get organizing rights to make it easier to organize non-union workers who have it worse than those, who already are unionized.
One of the things that struck me in your book was when you talk about the companies that actually treat their workers well, which you mentioned Costco and some other companies, and it might come as a surprise to those of us who continue to labor under less than ideal conditions in our workplaces. Can you talk about those companies and how they came to the philosophy that they pursue in their business?
Sure. In the book, I write about a lot of wrong things a company is doing, and I have chapter after chapter about companies that make people work off the clock, or managers that erase hours from people's time cards, or companies that horribly exploit undocumented workers. But I thought it would be important to show that there are some, even a lot of companies that do the right thing, that treat their workers very well. And at Costco, and I have a long section about Costco, the founder, Jim Sinegal, son of a Pennsylvanian who was a coal miner and a steel worker and a good union man, Sinegal had this vision that I'm going to treat my workers well. I'm going to have very low prices. I don't want anyone thinking that I have low prices because our workers work under sweatshop conditions. So he decided in setting up Costco that Costco would have the best wages and benefits of any retailer, general retailer in the nation.
And does it?
Generally, it does, yes. Someone working at Costco for, say, 5 years, their wages and benefit package together will be two and a half times what the wage and benefit package is together at Walmart. The health plan is extremely good. There's this funny story about Costco where each year they do a survey of their workers saying, what's the best thing about working at Costco? What's the worst thing about working at Costco? And one poll found that employees said the worst thing about working at Costco is they weren't allowed to wear shorts to work year-round. So imagine if that were the biggest complaint at every company in the United States. And Costco is a direct rival of Walmart. They're competing for the same shoppers who want discounts. Yet Costco's vision is if you pay your workers well, if you treat them well, they'll be loyal to you, they'll be very productive, and they'll smile to customers, and you want your customers to like you when they shop at your place.
And you say the CEO has been under a lot of pressure from Wall Street to change those conditions?
Well, there are folks on Wall Street who say, Sinegal, your prices are too low, you should raise your prices, your wages are too high, you could increase your profits by decreasing by holding down, by freezing your wages, by reducing your generous health benefits. And he sticks to his guns and he says, that's my vision and that's what we're going to do.
And some of the other companies that you mentioned?
So I write about Ernst & Young, you know, in Midtown Manhattan. I interviewed the former chairman of Ernst & Young, who said, you know, when I was growing up, all the smartest girls in high school, all the smartest young women in college, all the smartest people in college were women. And then he said when he went to work at Ernst & Young, you know, half the people hired were women, and they were the best workers, yet he was dismayed. He was shocked that only 5% of Ernst & Young's partners were women. So he said he's going to change that. So Ernst & Young has really, you know, he realized that the reason so many women were leaving in droves was that the job is too demanding. It made it, you know, nearly impossible to balance job and family. So he really developed, Ernst & Young has really developed this wonderful flex time model that other companies should seek to emulate, I think. You know, workers, female workers, male workers, if they want, they could decide to just work 3 days a week or just 4 days a week. And as long as you work more than 20 hours a week, you still get full benefits. People can work, you know, 70 hours a week in the months before tax time, and then they could take the summer off. I write about Patagonia, another wonderful company that believes in serious flex time. Patagonia in Ventura, California, right along the Pacific, kind of encourages its workers to go surfing at lunchtime. And they, you know, I interviewed some workers, they go surfing for 2 hours at lunchtime, and, you know, you think many companies would think that's outrageous, how are you going to get your work done? But Patagonia trusts its employees to use their flex time. You know, maybe they'll finish working the project at home at night.
Well, in terms of what needs to be done to change the trend now in terms of the treatment of American workers, if you had to single out one or two key turnarounds that the country needs, what would they be?
Very quickly, I think we've lost one-fifth of our manufacturing jobs since the year 2000. 3.5 million jobs, generally, you know, good middle-class jobs with very good benefits. The nation, by and large, has paid way too little attention about strengthening its manufacturing sector, and I think it's important to do that. One way to do that is put a greater focus on green jobs, which can be manufacturing jobs, making solar panels, making hybrid cars. A second thing, I think you know, the nation, by and large, hasn't paid enough respect to workers as workers. You know, all the attention is about, you know, the Bill Gates, the Warren Buffetts, the A-Rods, the Paris Hiltons, and not enough about workers. I think workers, in many ways, have become invisible as workers. They're seen as Bud drinkers or Oprah watchers, but they're not really seen as workers who, you know, bust their derrieres day in and day out, you know, making the trains run on time, you know, cleaning hotel rooms. And I think if the news media, if politicians really started paying more attention, more respect to workers, that might discourage corporations, CEOs from squeezing their workers so much. A third very quick thing is, I think universal health coverage is very important because whether you're working, you're constantly forking over more money each year for health premiums, or if you're laid off, you know, you're in the same position that you, your spouse, your kids might lose health insurance. I think universal health insurance is key to making life less insecure for workers.
And we got about 30 seconds. How many labor reporters are there in American newspapers these days?
You do a wonderful job for the Daily News.
You
beat me on too many stories. I'm embarrassed to talk about that. The Wall Street Journal has a good young labor reporter. You know, Steve Franklin at the Chicago Tribune is a terrific labor reporter. He's done a lot of great stuff about immigrant workers. But it's a very small group. The LA Times no longer has a labor reporter. And the Washington Post really no longer has one, and it's sad. I want more competition in this business.
More competition, right? Okay, I want to thank you, Steve Greenhouse. The book is The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker, continuing labor reporter for the New York Times, Steve Greenhouse. That does it for today's program. If you want to get a copy of the show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now! See you tomorrow.